Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Fraud Files, Decoding the Economic Crime Act, the podcast from Herbert Smith Freehills, in which we are breaking down key elements of the Act, and in particular, the new offence of failure to prevent fraud. My name's Elizabeth Head, and I'm an off-counsel in HSF's Corporate Crime and Investigations team in London. And I'm delighted to be joined today by two of my colleagues, Rob Hunt and Shannon Casey Black, where we are going to be focusing in particular on the concept of associated persons under the Act. Before we delve into the detail, I will do some introductions. So Rob, if I can start with you, welcome. And would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Thanks, Liz. Hi, everyone. I'm Rob Hunt. I'm a partner in the Corporate Crime and Investigations team here in London.
Thank you. And Shannon.
Hi, everyone. I'm Shannon. I'm a senior associate in the Corporate Crime and Investigations team here in London as well.
Thank you. I will start with you, Shannon, if I may. And to get started, can you just remind us of the key elements of failure to prevent fraud and the role that associated persons play in that?
Of course. Thanks, Liz. So the essential elements of the offence are that a person associated with a large organisation commits a relevant fraud offence over which the UK has jurisdiction. So pausing there, today we're focusing on associated persons. And we've focused on the concepts of large organisation, relevant fraud offence, and the jurisdictional test in our previous episodes, so we won't be delving into those concepts here today. Next, in all scenarios, the relevant fraud offence must be committed by the associated person with the intention, whether direct or indirect, of benefiting either the relevant body or any person to whom or to whose subsidiary the associate provides services for or on behalf of the relevant body. Think customers, clients, and the like. We'll be focusing a bit more on intention today, but it's important to say that the fraud offences committed without the requisite intention will not attract liability for the company. So, for example, where the company is the victim of the fraud. And then finally, the offence will apply where the relevant body did not have in place relevant fraud prevention procedures, which we'll touch on a bit later.
Great. Thank you very much. And so, Rob, who are going to be the types of associated persons that will be relevant for this offence?
Thanks, Liz. So, yeah, the definition of associated person for the failure to prevent fraud offence is an employee, an agent, or a subsidiary undertaking of the relevant body, or any person who otherwise performs services on behalf of the body. So it automatically in scope are employees, agents, subsidiaries, and employees of subsidiaries. And also included are those who perform services on behalf of the body. So that could include third-party service providers, contractors, sales agents, and third-party distributors.
So plenty of different categories of people to think about.
And just to add that in terms of sort of any assessment of whether or not any person is performing services on behalf of the body, the statute says that that's to be determined by reference to all relevant circumstances and not merely the relationship or by reference to the nature of the relationship between the person and the relevant body.
Thank you. Now, associated person is a term that might be familiar to some of our listeners. They may have come across it in other failure to prevent offences, failure to prevent bribery, failure to prevent the facilitation of tax evasion. Is the concept here the same as in those other offences, Shannon?
Thanks, Liz. So there are similarities across the definitions. And like you mentioned, this concept of associated person does come across in each of the offences. There is a common thread. So they all capture the acts of persons who provide services for or on behalf of the relevant body. While they're technically framed in slightly different ways, this category of persons is consistently to be assessed by reference to all of the relevant circumstances, like Rob just mentioned. Like Rob said, the failure to prevent fraud offence automatically captures employees, agents, subsidiaries, and employees of subsidiaries. This is where the offence is slightly broader than the previous offences that we've seen. persons falling in these categories will automatically be in scope for the failure to prevent fraud offence without any assessment of the relevant circumstances. In contrast, under the Bribery Act, there's a rebuttable presumption that employees are associated persons, but there's also a carve-out in the Act if the contrary is shown based on an assessment of the relevant circumstances. The failure to prevent fraud offence doesn't contain any such carve-outs. Again, under the Criminal Finances Act, this one is a bit more similar to failure to prevent fraud in that it applies automatically to employees and agents, but it doesn't apply automatically to subsidiaries or employees of subsidiaries like failure to prevent fraud. But unlike the failure to prevent fraud offence, the associated person must be acting in the capacity of an associated person at the time the offence is committed. The fraud offence contains no such requirement regarding capacity, but in practice, a fraud offence committed in another capacity, so for example, a third-party distributor acting for another client or an employee acting in their personal capacity, is unlikely to be committed with the relevant intention.
Great, thank you, Shannon. I think this is one of those areas where it's very helpful to have some examples to bring those categories off the page and bring them to life a bit. So Rob, could you give us a few examples of how this might play out in practice?
Yes, of course. And this is obviously the key question that everyone's thinking about as to how in practice this may create liability. I think, you know, the key thing to consider is that there, as we've said before, there must be an intention to benefit the relevant the company. And so even if the associated person commits a fraud intending to benefit themselves, if there is also an intention to benefit the company, then that is will potentially create liability. So the types of situations we think that are likely to be applicable here or create liability include, for example, accounting fraud, where an employee, for example, inflates their business unit's financials. They may be motivated to do that to meet their own KPIs, which may be tied to their own bonus. But at the same time, that would also create a benefit for the company by creating a more favorable economic impression of the company, which in turn may be used to attract investment and funding and the like. So that's certainly one case that we think is an example of where this offence might bite. In the sales context, so fraudulent statements made by sales agents, third parties, distributors about, for example, the company's products in the market, they may well also attract liability. Of particular interest also is at the moment is greenwashing and statements made by employees publicly facing statements about their green credentials may also attract liability if there's an intention to benefit the company. So those are sort of potential examples. And again, we've got to be looking there at whether or not there's an intention to benefit the company.
Thanks very much, Rob. So plenty of actually quite disparate scenarios that people are going to have to be thinking about, given the sort of breadth of fraud and the different ways it can manifest itself. Taking the contrary approach, can we look at a few examples, Shannon, of situations that aren't likely to fall within the Act? So third party activities that don't meet the relevant tests.
Sure, Liz. So a good example of this is if you have, say, a third-party scammer that uses the company's information to impersonate the company to commit a fraud. Assuming there are no complicit employees working with the scammer, the fraudster is unlikely to be an associated person because they're not, in this instance, providing services for or on behalf of the company. There's also no intention of the fraudster to benefit the company. It's for their own personal gain. I think in practice, another area where this might come up is, say, on complicated projects. Take, for example, a construction project where you have a lot of third-party contractors. if you have a contractor who's providing services for the company and they're negotiating with other customers and suppliers on the project and they, say, falsify some records so that they can pocket the difference and benefit in that way. In this circumstance, the third party is likely to be an associated person if they're providing services, but the company here is more likely to be the intended victim of the fraud. It's hard to see how the company, which is being defrauded by this customer and this third party, could benefit in this circumstance. So that's one to think about as well.
Thank you very much. And I should say at this stage that we haven't delved very much into corporate structures, so subsidiaries, employees of subsidiaries, and how that can tie back to the parent. That is because this is quite a complex area to work through under the Act, and it's actually something that we're going to tackle on its own in a separate episode. So look out for that one, particularly any listeners who are within relatively complex group structures and are thinking about how that plays out within the organisation. We will be coming back to that in its own dedicated episode. Before we finish off, as I think listeners will probably be aware, we're expecting guidance on the reasonable procedures that companies should be taking under the Act. That's due to be released before these offences come into force and hopefully later this year. But until then, what should companies be thinking about in relation to their associated persons, Rob?
That's a good question, Liz. And we have been speaking to clients about this new offence, and there's certainly concern, particularly around third parties and risk that that third parties may create for companies. And I think at this point, really, it's prudent to start thinking about the risks that are associated with different categories of third persons that companies work with. That may be a number of different categories of people from, when we've talked about some examples earlier, including third party agents, contractors, distributors. I think companies will already probably have a bit of a sense of the risk associated with those types of third parties, for example, if there's been any incidents in the past. But really it's a case of starting to think around the risk profile and the controls that are in place around those third parties and whether or not they may need to be enhanced. There are obviously parallels here with third parties for relating to that need to be risk assessed to prevent liability under the Bribery Act. But those third parties may not necessarily be the same. It's probably a good starting point. But for example, if you're concerned about sales agents in Africa or China, you may be more concerned about a bribery risk there. But then there may also be fraud risk with those third parties, because often bribery and fraud overlap. Because of the jurisdictional nexus of this new Act, it may be that those third parties don't create a failure to prevent fraud risk in the same way that they will under the Bribery Act. So there are going to be differences there. But I think as a starting point, it's really just to map out which third parties are there and the risks that are associated with it.
Thanks very much. So plenty for people to be thinking about. But as you say, Rob, hopefully there's some stuff there that companies can draw on that they've got in place already around bribery, even if it needs to be refocused or enhanced to look at fraud risk. Thank you very much to both of you for the really interesting discussion. Thank you to those who've listened, and please stay tuned for our next episode where we're going to continue breaking down key elements of the Act. We're going to be looking also in more detail at how it's going to impact different sectors. So stay tuned.